it is indeed coming home to return to this beautiful headquarters. And I appreciate John not going on too long. As I told him, it always reminds me of the story of the minister who was being introduced at great length with all of his accomplishments and all of the various things that could be said about him, and practically giving the talk also and saying, now we will hear from the Reverend Mr. Smith. We will now have the address by the Reverend Mr. Smith. And he stood up and said, my address is 212 East Kensington Boulevard. You may reach me there. And he sat down. So it's true. But it's also true that I have many homes. But one of the interesting things, I think, is the human proclivity, somehow we have a penchant for naming periods in history. It's not quite clear just exactly how we will designate the 20th century, now that we've moved into the 21st. I doubt that we will call it the Age of Enlightenment. We may call it the Age of the Great Wars, or a variety of other things that may come along, but certainly we've called it the Atomic Age, the Scientific Age, the Technological Age, the Information Age, and so on. I would hope profoundly that with the influence and continuing influence, and I think the growing influence of theosophical ideas, which doesn't mean the influence of the society per se as a society, but through the society, the growing influence of theosophical ideas on world thought in almost every field, that the 21st century might indeed possibly become the age of becoming human, or of being human, the human age, which in effect also means the humane age, a period in which we really learn what it means to be truly human. And I say this because some 50 years ago, the eminent Swiss psychologist Dr. Carl Jung proposed that the events of world history are, in the last analysis, really unimportant, because the essential thing is the life of the individual. And he said, this alone makes history, the life of every individual. Because, he said, here alone do the great transformations first take place. And the whole future, the whole history of the world, spring as a gigantic summation from these hidden sources in individuals. And he concluded this particular statement by adding that in our most private and subjective lives, we are not only the passive witnesses of our age and its sufferers, but also its makers. And so it seems to me that the time really has come that we should look at the opportunities, the responsibilities, the challenges that are before us as individuals, and to make those hard choices which will determine whether we continue as passive witnesses, which we perhaps have been for far too long, passive witnesses to the whole story of history and the development of events, and become genuine makers of the kind of world in which we really want to live. And that means, I think, being responsible as human beings, accepting the challenge that it is to be human. During the 20th century, it is true, we we really displayed a remarkable talent in defining the world. That is, we mapped the heavens, a project still in process, of course. We continue to explore. We sent men to the moon. We have sent instruments to Mars. We're now involved in establishing a space station. We've explored some of the nearest planets, at least by the Hubble telescope, and sent back pictures and so on. The genetic code was cracked in the 20th century, and the genome project is said to be nearly completed. We have a detailed map, therefore, of our biological life. Our technical language has grown beyond all imagination. A vocabulary, really, that is so esoteric that many of us born, well, I won't say how many years ago, but many years ago into the earlier part of the 20th century, really do not understand a great deal of the technical language. Our national president here, John Aljo, can tell you, and Adele can tell you, how many new words were added to the English language in the 20th century. And I'm sure it's a staggering number, really. And most of them, I rather imagine, and I'm going out on a limb, and I'll hear about this if I'm wrong, but I rather imagine a great majority of them are technical terms. And certainly having to do with the life of a computer. Because computers have lives of their own. I've discovered that long since. So many thinkers have pointed out that there is really today no lack of technological knowledge with which to solve the problems that confront us still, problems of pollution, of energy shortage, and I can speak about that at first hand because I do live in California now, and we are experiencing what are known as rolling blackouts. If you want to, it's a very strange term, a rolling blackout, you know. It depends on where the curtain comes down, this black curtain, in what part of the state of California. But we could solve these problems of health and security, of undernourishment and overpopulation. We're capable of building a world economic order that would benefit both rich and poor. The application of appropriate agricultural technologies could serve to increase food supplies without genetic alteration of plants and animals or the continued cruelty and abuse of animals. We have heard much, of course, particularly in the closing years of the 20th century, about globalization. But for a truly global vision, I suggest that the concept of interexistence needs to replace that tired idea that we've used for so long of coexistence. Because coexistence means we simply get along somehow. Interexistence indicates that we really understand the way in which our lives are intermeshed, interlinked, and also our lives are interlinked and interexist with the planet on which we dwell and all of its inhabitants. And for that, a shift in consciousness is certainly required. It must take place. So that it seems to me that the message of the Theosophical Society, the message of the Theosophical worldview, means that we are willing to confront the central issue with which we ultimately, each one of us, must deal. Not the problems that are external to us, but ourselves. Our central concern must be our own humanity. What is it to be human? In what does our humanity really consist? What does it mean to be human? No one really has put the issue more clearly than Arthur Diekmann in his work Bimodal Consciousness, in which he says very much of what I have just suggested, that the crises now facing the human race are technically solvable. As he put it, controlling population, reducing pollution, eliminating racism and war do not require new inventions, but they prove fatally insolvable because what is required is a shift in values. And it is only human beings, we, who can engage in that kind of interior shift in values, in self-definition, in a worldview on the part of each one of us. For it is the individual consciousness, as indeed Carl Jung put it, that is the problem. Our survival is threatened not because of our great success in manipulating our environment and acting on others, but because we have permitted that manipulation to stand in place of human values, of doing what really is the human thing to do. And quite simply, I think we need to wake up to the fact that only as we as individuals think in new ways and act in accordance with a different set of values from those that guided us in the past, can we indeed bring about the kind of world in which we want to live. We are the world. This has been said again and again. But to awaken to that fully and wholly and be willing to accept it in our individual lives is another matter. Our uniqueness, the uniqueness of our humanity, is of a psychological order. Yes, and I'd like to put it this way. Yes, we derive our essential being from a spiritual realm, and we derive our incarnate existence from the biological and physical realm. But in between, and it's that in-between area that it seems to me we experience as the truly human area, is the psychological realm. That realm of our attitudes, our thoughts, our feelings. Attitudes and all the actions that are prompted by our attitudes. So the task, basically, is one of growth in consciousness. It's not simply to recognize that we have spiritual origins, or that we, in our incarnate existence, have biological origins, but that in that in-between realm of thought, feeling, the psychic realm, if you like, the psychological realm, that here is our great challenge to come awake. It's basically then a shift in consciousness, a growth in consciousness, a transformation of consciousness, or perhaps better yet, an awakening of consciousness, a coming awake to our responsibility for everything we do and think and feel. For I would like to suggest that the opposite of being human is not the animal, nor are we simply an extension of an animal condition, a highly refined animal with the faculty of reason and the skill of tool making added to our equipment. The opposite of being human is the demonic. And we have seen, those of us who have lived for the major part of our lives, and a great deal of the 20th century, we have seen the demonic sweep over our world. We have seen the demonic let loose in the world through human beings who gave themselves over to the demonic. But now, surely, the time has come to face up to the demons that we have let loose, to tame the demons within, if you like, and so transform them into being truly human. The Jewish thinker, Dr. Abraham Heschel, has put it this way: every generation has a definition of man it deserves. I've retained his exact words, but we can put it in another way if to be politically correct in the non-sexist language. Every generation has a definition of being human that it deserves. And accepting a definition of ourself is a way of identifying ourselves, holding up a mirror in which to scan our own face. Is it the face of being human? Sometimes we think, well, it's so wonderful to be godlike. I think before one can be godlike, one needs to be human. And then one knows what it is to be godlike. We may no longer call ourselves the human animal, as was often the case in the 19th century. We've substituted the human machine, seeing ourselves built on the model of computers. And certainly the computer can think or calculate faster, at least. It can turn out poetry of a kind, art, music. It can communicate with other computers at a rate far beyond our normal capacity. And well, of course, we're not staring at the monitor of a computer, we're staring at the television screen. And one novelist of the 20th century, therefore, referred to such people as dead souls who have given up any sense of individual identity, and indeed, we become known only by our email addresses. And so we move further from each other because we can engage in the chat rooms on our computers without ever having to confront each other. We can argue, debate, find out all sorts of things in the chat rooms on all the websites that one can explore. But to meet each other face to face, to look into the eyes of another and to be human, to look at nature, not talk about it, not describe it, but to see it, to be with it. This is really what is needed to be human. I'm reminded of the somber and often very disturbing novels of one of the most influential writers of the 20th century, Franz Kafka, who was a master of the art of picturing people who do not use their potential humanity and therefore lose their sense of personhood. In what probably his most famous work, The Trial, you may remember Kafka gives his chief character no name, identified only by an initial, a mute symbol of a lack of identity. And in what I think is the most frightening parable that he wrote, Metamorphosis, Kafka illustrated what happens when a human being forfeits his human powers. The hero of a story, if you may remember it, is a typical empty modern young man, living a routine life, returning regularly from his rounds as a salesman to his typical middle-class home, eating the same menu every Sunday, of course. And Kafka implies that the man's life is so empty of meaning, of purpose, of identity, of personhood, by having him wake up one morning no longer a human being, but a cockroach. He had not fulfilled his humanness, and he'd forfeited the right to be human. In certain Buddhist texts, the human responsibility, or our humanness, is often summarized in four propositions, I'll call them. This is true also, incidentally, one sees it in other texts, the texts of Advaita Vedanta, the great work of Shankaracharya, in Plato, in what Socrates says. And the first is simply that we have an obligation to decide now what our values, our actions in effect, how we will define ourselves. How do you define yourself? And we must decide here and now, because the one thing that is certain is death. The one thing that is uncertain is the hour of death. And so one must decide here and now, by our actions, our values, to be human, so that at the moment of death, that is present. And consequently, the second proposition, our humanity is not an accident. It is the outcome of our actions. We are human because we act like human beings. And the third is simply that therefore we are under obligation to act in such a manner as to preserve our humanity, to be human at every moment. And this is possible, consequently, only as we are reminded of our humanity at every moment. And to be reminded of our humanity is indeed to be in that kind of relationship in which we are always reminded of what it means to be human. Dr. Heschel, to whom I referred earlier, pointed to much the same when he wrote, "It is indeed conceivable that man may continue to be without being human," adding that dehumanization is the liquidation of being human. According to the great Christian mystic, Meister Eckhart, Saint Dionysius said that the human being requires but three things. The first is the possession of one's mind. The second is a mind that is free. And the third is a mind that can see. So what all of these statements are pointing to, from the 20th century novelist Kafka to Buddhist, Jewish, and Christian texts, is, I believe, the central issue that now confronts us. As we look out upon the world, it is not the external conflicts that are taking place. Palestinian-Israeli conflicts, conflicts in the Balkans, the difficulties still arising from the earthquake in Gujarat in North India. It's the ability to be truly human in a way that brings to bear all of our humanity on the solution of these, not outside us, but within us. This is what has been called the pivotal doctrine in that wisdom tradition which we call theosophy. And so for over a century and a quarter, 126 years, the Theosophical Society has existed to awaken humankind to its essential task, to become human. If we would awaken our God-given faculties, if we would live together in harmony, interexist, not just coexist, but interexist on this small planet, we must become authentically human in the most beautiful meaning of that word. So it was H.P. Blavatsky, one of the founders and perhaps the principal teacher in the early years of the Theosophical Society, the individual who most clearly and forcibly chartered its essential mission, rephrasing again and again an ancient and ageless wisdom in words that are still magnificent statements of that wisdom tradition. And she put the goal very succinctly. In one of the final books that she wrote, the second to the last, known as The Key to Theosophy, she wrote, when asked about the work of the society, what it was to exist for, that the society had been established to assist in showing that such a thing as theosophy exists, and to help people, I'm paraphrasing this, to ascend towards it by studying and assimilating its eternal verities. Those simple words, of course, guided and inspired the work of her students through the final years of the 19th century. They served as a directive for countless numbers of theosophical students through all the tumultuous years of the 20th century. And they are still words that call us to discover what it is, that magical and often very mysterious thing, not a thing at all, but a way of looking at life that is called theosophy. Much may have changed and has changed. Language, modes of communication, methods of transportation, so much else since Blavatsky wrote those words. But their essential meaning and what they point to and the challenge they contain has not altered. What is most significant, if we understand all that is implied by those words, is that there is a wisdom, a knowing, a genuine knowing, which we may call theosophy. A wisdom, sophos, that one may study it, but one must also assimilate it. That is, it must become part of the very fiber of our being. We must eat it, which is to assimilate it. We must eat it, and therefore live it. Because it is true. Even at the physical level, you are what you eat. It is transformed into everything that we are. And just so at the psychological level, we are what we think and what we feel, what our attitudes are, what our values are. These define us in terms of how we face the world and how we act in the world. So while we speak of theosophy as divine wisdom, theos in its essential meaning is not simply godlike or divine, but the becoming of that which really is the very essence of our divinity. That is to say, what does it mean to be God, godlike? It is to be creative, and those creative capacities are of the nature of the divine. And we need to awaken those creative capacities that transform our own consciousness, that enable us to act in new ways, ways that are not really new, but are truly human ways. The human alone has the responsibility for that kind of awakening. And so this constitutes, as H.P. Blavatsky said herself, the pivotal doctrine of this philosophy. She put it this way: the pivotal doctrine of the esoteric philosophy admits no privileges or special gifts in the human being, save those won by our own psychological nature through personal effort and merit throughout a long series of metempsychoses and reincarnations. Interesting that she puts the change, the transformation of the psychological nature, the change of consciousness before reincarnation. It is not that, yes, we will die, of course, that we will wake up in some new incarnation and the world will be better for it, or the world will have changed enough that we get along better with our neighbors, but rather that the change must come now. It is not through any process of reincarnation as normally understood, but of metempsychosis, a total change of consciousness. This is the essential task, to assimilate the eternal verities by living them, those eternal verities that proclaim that there is indeed but one life, however diverse may be the forms in which it expresses itself, that there is order in the universe, there is design, there is pattern. It's interesting that every being, in every organism, there is one and only one central need in life to fulfill its own potentialities. The acorn must inevitably become the oak. The puppy must become the dog. The caterpillar must become the moth or butterfly. The human task has never been that clearly defined, and hence is much more difficult. What is the pattern for our humanity? What is it that we are striving to become? The patterns of harmony, of rhythmic unfoldment, the eternal truths are there, and we live them through personal effort and merit, as Blavatsky proposed, by bringing about that transformation of consciousness implied by the word metempsychosis, becoming truly and fully human, which means basically accepting responsibility for our choices. At every moment, accepting responsibility for the choices that we make, which also means being aware of the choices. Most of us make choices rather unconsciously and then wonder afterwards about the consequences and say, oh, that should never have happened to me, or I didn't mean it. Dear Lord, please, I didn't mean it, so don't give me the consequences of it. But to become fully conscious of the choices we make at every moment, choices that indeed have to do with the whole broad range of our living in the world as it is, choices that we can call ecological choices, if you like. Accepting responsibility for achieving self-consciousness, responsibility for making or remaking our world, no longer being passive witnesses, but as Jung put it, becoming the makers of our age. I may seem to be making the whole matter perhaps quite complicated, so let me put it another way. Recently, I was reading a book by my good friend, Dr. Ravi Ravindra, whom many of you know, of course, and who has spoken from this platform and many theosophical platforms around the world. In this particular book, which is not on the general market, but which he had privately published, and which he gave me a copy, a beautiful book in which he recorded his work along the lines of the Gurdjieffian teachings, work that he undertook with one of Gurdjieff's chief disciples, Madame de Saltzman in Paris. Teachings that really are not dissimilar from the theosophical worldview. On one occasion, he records, he was commenting to his teacher, Madame de Saltzman, somewhat critically, about the leadership that had been given to the group in which he was an individual, the leadership of one particular individual in this group in which he was a member. And she listened to him patiently, all of this criticism. And then when he had completed his critique, very careful critique, she turned to him and said, very simply, "Did you help?" And it made him aware, he said, at once, of the responsibility that he had not taken. It's a question, I think, that should stay with us whenever we deplore the current situation, whether personal circumstances, or a situation in our surroundings, or even a crisis in the world. Did I help? Did my thoughts, my reactions, my feelings, my presence, help or hinder, bring light or project darkness, give strength or contribute to the problem? In one way, it's as simple and yet as difficult as that. To be human means, did I help? Where were my thoughts, my feelings? What were my actions? How did I respond in any situation? Because to be human implies the capacity for making choices. And upon the choices we make will depend the further development of our human and so our divine potential. A price is always paid for the birth of the authentic self, and the price is the price of our choices. There is what may be a deeply significant reference to this fact in the first letter of St. Paul, the great initiate St. Paul, to the Corinthians. "For you are bought with a price, therefore glorify God in your body and in your spirit." May I suggest that the meaning of this is a very simple one. The reference to the two poles of our being, body and spirit, incarnation, and that from which that ultimate one reality from which all life has proceeded. The inner and outer modes of our humanness, if you like, and to glorify that creative spirit, the Godhead within, is indeed to act from that psychological nature which is purified of any self-interest, of any greed, envy, jealousy, hatred, any of the demonic powers that would overtake us. The way to become human, the way to self-realization, has never been portrayed as an easy road. Remember the statement in the Tao Te Ching, "The way out into the light often looks dark. The way that goes ahead often looks as though it went back." So if we would discover or rediscover that primordial light of our being from which we derive our humanity, it may often appear that facing those demons within is a way that is dark and forbidding. In actuality, we may call it a transformation of consciousness. The work is really the recovery of our authentic self, the truly human, the archetypal human, if you like. H.P. Blavatsky refers to it in The Secret Doctrine in the terms the heavenly man, by which she meant really that archetype for that human state which carries the whole process of unfoldment, the whole process of the growth of life itself forward in a meaningful way. The task calls, I think, for a courage of spirit, yes, a bravery of the soul, a willingness to enter into the depths of our own being if we would ascend the heights in full self or divine consciousness. The struggle takes place within, which is why I suggest H.P.B., Blavatsky, spoke first of metempsychosis and then of reincarnation. But an inner struggle that never takes place in complete isolation, for it is only in relationship that we discover or recover our humanity. To know what it means to be human, we have to be authentically related first to ourselves, to all the elements within ourselves, related to each other, recognizing that interexistence that exists among us, which is why the first object of the Theosophical Society speaks of brotherhood, a relationship that is established, related to all the life about us, related to plant, animal, rock, even to the earth itself. So while we've developed a tremendously useful vocabulary of technology, a language about things, we've neglected, perhaps even lost if we ever had, a language of interpersonal relationships. Note, for example, how the very word love has been degraded by our popular culture. And yet, what does it mean but a relationship that is pure, that is beautiful? Perhaps we need to learn the language of our humanity, which means to move from a condition in which we are unthinking and unfeeling, an unfree part of the collective mass, through the experience of true self-awareness to an ever-widening consciousness of that self which is the self in all. A movement through all the crises of personal growth to a progressive integration of ourselves with others in a freely chosen relationship that is creative, that is loving, that is meaningful. Each step in the journey means that we live less as a servant of a slave of automatic time. Age becomes irrelevant, and more as a conscious, choosing, responsible human being working in perfect concord with the thrust of evolution itself. A slave of automatic time, because the process of becoming human is not a process in time, which may involve reincarnation, as a process that involves the proper use of time here and now, in this moment, in a constructive dealing with the here-ness, the now-ness of our situation. If we are content to live in the when of the future and the then of the past, we live artificially, superficially, automatically, without freedom. It takes courage to live in the now, to be human at this moment, to look at each other and to express that humanity. What happens when I meet another person, even in the most casual of meetings? And believe me, I have many of them in airports, on airplanes, all around the world. And I meet some fascinating people who sit next to me, perhaps waiting for the flight to go. I could give you many stories, but that would bore you beyond tears. But so often, you know, and to just be there with the person, as the person may express anxiety because the flight's going to be late. And I always think, I've come to the condition, really, it really doesn't matter. The flight is late. I'm sorry if I inconvenience somebody who's meeting me, but that's the way it is. Why be anxious? I simply can't become the pilot of the plane and get it off the landing place any faster than the pilot will do it. So even in the most casual of meetings, I am in the presence of another, of others. Even if I do not say anything, I communicate by my presence as others communicate by their presence. And what I communicate will depend upon the value I place upon the other. And to a large extent, this value will depend on the value I place upon myself. Do I need to be the first one off the flight? Eventually the plane will empty. I will get out. And people are wonderful, you know, when you need help. That I can assure you. But if I'm critical, if by my thoughts, my feelings, my actions, I demean the other, and the other may even be an animal, of course, then I have failed to give support to the other, to encourage growth in the other. Did I help? Think again of that question. For the injunction to love your neighbor as yourself was no idle commandment, nor was it a permission to be self-centered in our loving. An injunction, rather, to value the human self sufficiently as to enable one to love the other as the mirror image of oneself, the representation of one's own being. To perceive the uniqueness of the self revealed in the preciousness of the other. The other may not seem dear to me in some intrinsic manner, but the other is dear to himself or herself, and it is this essence of dearness, this preciousness in every living thing, be it rock, the earth, a blade of grass, or the stars in the sky, or the person we pass on the street. That dearness that must be acknowledged wherever we meet another. To be human is to know the dearness, the preciousness of all others, and act in such a way that the other too becomes aware of that dearness. This is harmonious and founded on an act, an ethic of self-giving, the ethic of our truly being human. And out of such an ethic, founded on the inner harmony of one's being, in which speech and action are in complete accord, there arises an infinite patience with ourselves. The kind of patience or true forbearance so beautifully expressed by St. Paul in his letter to the Galatians. Brothers, he wrote, if a man be overtaken in a fault, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in the spirit of meekness. Consider thyself, lest thou also be tempted. Bear ye one another's burdens. Very similar words were spoken by the fifth Dalai Lama, who lived in the early 17th century. He wrote, "The way of thinking which prevails nowadays consists in looking, as it were, at the misery of others from the viewpoint of an extroverted mind, and in quoting a few scriptural texts. It is never a load on one's heart." Today, I suppose we would go on saying, "Well, I'm sorry, it's your karma." But to sustain a load on one's heart, patient understanding is necessary. The realization that the load of another is one's own. And this calls for that bravery of spirit, that dauntless energy, born of the perception that there is but one self, indeed. How do we then define our humanity? And let us make this 21st century the age of humanity. Humanity's age of moving forward together. It is only when we take up that challenge, I think, of becoming the makers of this century, the builders and architects of this age, that we will indeed bring about a genuine peace in the world, a creative peace, not a static peace, not a stagnant peace, but a creative and exciting and adventurous peace. For humanity does begin and end with the individual, as Carl Jung pointed out, as in the excerpt I quoted. Dr. Heschel stated the same principle when he wrote, "It is always one person at a time whom we keep in mind when we pledge with malice toward none, with charity for all." To become and to be human. This means to live out our humanity, to live as truly human beings every day, every moment, keeping in mind that question, did I help? So we can only begin now. And remember, when Socrates was describing the ideal way of life, the ideal community, the ideal society, his comrade Glaucon, at least according to Plato, countered, "Socrates, I don't believe there is such a city of God anywhere on earth." And I expect there are those who say to us, who try to live in this way, "I don't believe that brotherhood will ever work." But Socrates responded, "Whether such a city exists in heaven or ever will exist on earth, the wise man will live after the manner of that city, having nothing to do with any other, and in so looking upon it, will set his own house in order."